From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with jazz musician, composer, and arranger Bob Wilbur. Wilbur led the Smithsonian Jazz Repertory Ensemble. This weekend, he'll lead a Carnegie Hall tribute to the late Benny Goodman, celebrating the 50th anniversary of Goodman's famous Carnegie Hall concert. Also today, I talk with Kate Clinton, a stand-up comic with a lesbian feminist perspective. After years of performing at women's conferences and festivals, she's now playing America's top comedy clubs. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new recording of the Philip Glass opera Akhenaten, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines how, in the postmodern era, words don't carry the weight they used to. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. This Saturday night, Bob Wilbur will lead a Carnegie Hall concert in tribute to the late clarinetist Benny Goodman. It's a celebration of the 50th anniversary of Goodman's precedent-setting 1938 Carnegie Hall concert. New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot described Bob Wilbur as a superb soprano saxophonist, a classic clarinetist, a gifted arranger and composer, and an invaluable preserver and enhancer of jazz tradition. Bob Wilbur came of age in the 1940s, but unlike most of the jazz musicians of his generation, he wasn't interested in the modern idiom bebop. Wilbur's mentor was the New Orleans musician Sidney Bechet. Wilbur studied with him, played with him, even moved in with him. Today, Wilbur's repertoire includes music by many of the composers who created the language of jazz, such as Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Jelly Roll Morton, and James P. Johnson. Wilbur co-founded the New York Jazz Repertory Company and led the Smithsonian Jazz Repertory Ensemble. Wilbur arranged and conducted the music recreations for the movie Cotton Club, which was set in Harlem in the 1930s. His autobiography, Music Was Not Enough, will be published in the United States next month. He joins us today from the NPR Bureau in New York. Before we listen to some of his records, this is an excerpt of Don't Be That Way from Benny Goodman's 1938 Carnegie Hall concert, a song Wilbur will perform this Saturday at the tribute. Bob Wilbur, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to be here.
You're doing a tribute to the Benny Goodman 1938 Carnegie Hall concert. What makes that concert so important in jazz history?
A lot of things. It was the first time that jazz was presented at Carnegie Hall, which probably the first time that jazz was really presented in the right way in a concert hall in the United States. I think that was important, and it was a time when the popular culture, a figure who in his day was maybe the equivalent of, say, a Michael Jackson or a Prince, was presented to the cultural elite of New York and was a big hit. He went from there to the Paramount Theater the next week, where he was playing for the teenagers and the kids. It was a great event because it showed black and white musicians working together on the same stage, which in 1938 was still a rarity.
Now, what approach are you taking in your concert on Saturday? Are you playing transcriptions, or are you copying the solos that were done in the 1938 concert?
We're using all the same arrangements that Benny Goodman used, and we've acquired them from the Lincoln Center Library and from the Yale University Library, where Benny left them. And we are going to be very careful to recreate all the arrangements. The solos will be left to the discretion of the players, but they are all know the tradition, so the solos will be totally in keeping with the style.
I want our listeners to hear some of your playing.
Okay.
So I'm going to play a recent recording that you made with the late pianist Dick Wellstood.
Yes, he was a dear friend of mine, and it was a great loss to jazz when he died very unexpectedly last summer. One of the great exponents of stride piano.
Well, we'll show off your soprano playing a little bit later, but this is a taste of your clarinet playing. This is my guest Bob Wilber along with Dick Wellstood at the piano playing U-U-U. Some really beautiful playing. Do you think of your tone as being influenced by Benny Goodman at all?
Well, he was my first role model, my first idol when I was a kid, just starting to play clarinet at the age of 13. And he's definitely an influence on me. Benny made the clarinet sing, and it's a very difficult instrument to sing on. It tends to be very cold and detached. And Benny made it a voice. So when you listen to his music, you're not hearing the clarinet. You're hearing Benny Goodman.
Now, you played in Goodman's band briefly. This was when? Was it in the 1950s?
Yeah, late 50s. I played tenor saxophone in the band.
Now, he had a reputation of being a very cold band leader and of giving his musicians the ray, this really evil look from his eye, if they did something that he didn't like. In your forthcoming autobiography, Music Was Not Enough, you've written that you were somebody who could say to Goodman that his reed sounded bad without getting your head chopped off. Now, what made you able to say something like that to him?
Well, I think Benny respected me as a fellow clarinetist, although I must say when I was with his band, I played a precious little clarinet. But he respected my judgment, and he'd call me into the dressing room before a concert, and he'd say, "Well, how does this sound?" And I'd say, "Geez, that doesn't sound very good, Benny. That's not a very good reed." And he would listen to me, and then years afterwards, we used to get together at his apartment and play clarinet duets and compare notes and ideas about how to play this and how to play that. So we never had any kind of run-in. But Benny was a difficult leader. He was a perfectionist, and he demanded the highest standards of himself and expected everybody else to live up to those standards.
You've also said that when you were playing in his band, he tried to add some more modern tunes to the repertoire, but that the audience has really resisted that. Was that very disappointing?
It was disappointing to him, I think, because he'd gotten tired of playing all the same old things over and over again. As you know, around 1940, he added some brilliant new arrangers to his staff, like Eddie Sauter and Mel Powell, and he was constantly looking for new ideas and new material. But the public, they really wanted to hear Sing, 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 Don't Be That Way, Down South Camp Meeting, the old stuff. They never grew tired of that. And I know those people at Carnegie Hall are going to be delighted to hear exactly what was played in 1938. I remember one tour we did when we opened up in Rutland, Vermont, and it's the first time that Benny had been up there since 1939. And we just finished rehearsing some brilliant new arrangements by people like Bill Holman and Gil Evans and other fine arrangers. And we played the whole first half with these numbers. The audience sat on their hands. They were stunned because this is not what they came to hear. And Benny stormed off the stage, and when he didn't hear that applause, he was very mad. He says, "It's these damn modern arrangements. They're killing the music business. Take them all out of the book." He didn't like them because the audience didn't respond. We opened up the second half with "Don't Be That Way," and the audience tore their house down.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, you've led several repertory bands. When you're leading a repertory band, what do you want to bring to the music? I know you don't want to do a note for note transcription the way it was once recorded on record. What kind of life do you want to give to the music?
Well, you know, repertory playing is kind of a new idea in jazz. But it's something that we've had, in course, in classical music for hundreds of years. We play Mozart today, which is music written how many years ago? 300 years. We don't think of it as being old-fashioned. It's perfectly valid today. And I feel that all the different earlier styles of jazz are still just as valid, exciting, and good music today as they were when they were invented. And I believe you can be authentic to the original style, but bring something of yourself as a performer to the music, which is, in essence, what happens when classical performers play older music. They bring part of themselves to it. Of course, in jazz, improvisation is always an important part, and there's where the musicians bring their own personality to the music, whether it's Duke Ellington or Jelly Roll Morton or Benny Goodman or whatever.
What do you say to the people who would say, "Oh, but this stuff is already recorded on albums"? I mean, we don't need people to recreate it. We don't need to, you know, hear new versions of it.
I'll tell you, listening to, I don't care how good the fidelity is on records, there's nothing like an in-person live performance. And the exciting thing about in-person performances, particularly jazz, because of the improvisation, there's always the feeling that you may be hearing something that was never done before. You know, an improviser will suddenly get a spark and take off. This is part of the excitement of listening to jazz. It's like that famous night at Newport when Paul Gonzalez took off on crescendo and diminuendo and blue and played 26 choruses. It's like the famous moment at Carnegie Hall at the end of Sing, 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 when instead of going into the final ensemble, Benny pointed to Jess Stacy. Jess Stacy had never taken a piano solo in Sing, Sing, Sing. So he, off the top of his head, he improvised 2 minutes of the most beautiful music that you could imagine. It was one of the highlights of the concert.
Your mentor early on, when you were coming of age and first starting to play, your mentor then was Sidney Bechet. And I want to talk with you about studying with him and getting to know him. But first I want to play an excerpt of a recent recording that you made. You've led a band called Bechet Legacy, in which you play music associated with Bechet, and from one of your first albums, in fact, the first album in a series of records with Bechet Legacy, we're going to hear what I think is your theme song with that group, Petite Fleur.
Right. This was Sidney Bechet's most famous song. I'm sure it was a worldwide hit in 1959. Ironically, not Sidney's version. It was a version by an English band called Chris Barber, and with a clarinet player featured Monty Sunshine. But at that time, Sidney was dying in a hospital in France, and his music was being played all over the world. But at least Sidney went out with a burst of glory. He wasn't one of the forgotten pioneers like Jelly Roll Morton.
Well, let's hear Bob Wilbur's Bechet Legacy Group, and this is Petite Fleur. my guest Bob Wilbur, featured on soprano saxophone. Now Sidney Bechet was the great soprano saxophonist and clarinetist who came out of New Orleans, started recording in the 1920s, but you met him when he was living in Brooklyn, New York. This was in the 1940s, I believe, the late 1940s. What was the state of his life and his career when you started studying with him in Brooklyn, New York?
Well, he was over the really low period in his career in the 30s when he was running a tailor shop in Harlem, practically out of music. But he was kind of felt like he was going into semi-retirement and would devote himself to teaching. He felt the jazz world had sort of passed him by, and they were interested in more modern forms of jazz. And he wanted to be able to pass on to younger people his experiences in jazz. And he was delighted with me because I was very interested in his playing, and he felt very complimented about that. But he was living in comparative obscurity, and in light of what happened in the late 40s and the rest of his career, it's amazing to think that he was in such an obscure state, because his last 10 years living in France were one triumph after another. Million-selling records. He was a household name in France. He played all over Europe. It was a triumphal ending to a very checkered career.
Well, I want to speak with you more about your career and also your early studies with Sidney Bechet, but first we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Clarinetist and saxophonist Bob Wilbur is my guest. This Saturday, he will lead a tribute to Benny Goodman in a concert that marks the 50th anniversary of Goodman's 1938 Carnegie Hall performance. And Bob Wilbur is also the author of a forthcoming autobiography titled Music Was Not Enough, and that's due out probably next month. Well, Bob, let's talk about your studies with Bechet some more. Now, when you went to study with him in Brooklyn, you were a young man from the suburbs. Did you want Bechet to introduce you to the jazz life as well as to help you with jazz music?
Yeah, I really wanted to soak up every aspect of jazz, the life, the way musicians thought. You can get so much from listening to records, but if you don't get to know the players, you don't really know the whole story. And Sidney was like a second father to me. I lived with him, and then he started taking me on his jobs, and I get a chance to play with him.
How did you end up moving in with him?
Well, I was living down the village at that time, and my funds were rather low. And he said, well, look, why, instead of having to go back and forth to Manhattan all the time, why don't you come and live here with me? You can use the sofa in the upstairs parlor. And he was living with his wife there and a big Great Dane dog. And I just moved in. And he was working on some of his compositions. I used to help him write them down and record them. So I was helping him in his projects, too.
Is there any advice that he gave you about soloing or playing melody that's always stuck with you?
Yeah, his big thing was, he said, you have to tell a story in your music. You have to lead the listener along so that he gets into what you're doing and understands what you're doing. He said, first of all, you have to respect the melody of the song you're playing and give it the best treatment you can. And then when you make variations, they must make sense to the listener. The listener must hear the relationship of your variations to the original.
Now, didn't he tell you to stick with clarinet and stop fooling around with soprano?
Well, he said the clarinet is the basic instrument. He says once you've got that down, you'll find the saxophone is easy. But the clarinet is the fundamental instrument, and that's also what I tell my students. And I'd like to mention I have a particularly brilliant student who I'm very proud of, Antti Sarpila, who is from Helsinki, Finland. Antti's 23, and he's been studying with me since he was 16. And he is over here now, currently studying with me. And I had hoped very much to present him with my band at Carnegie Hall Saturday night. Unfortunately, we've run into a problem with the U.S. immigration, who says he doesn't have the proper work permit. So that won't be possible. But I just do want to mention him because I think he is the great young clarinetist who's going to pass, who I'm passing on my legacy to.
Has he moved in with you?
Well, virtually, because he has come to study with me every year for a month, and he's gotten grants from the Finnish government, and he's known in Finland as the Finnish Bob Wilbur.
When you got a little bit more mature with your own playing, did you want to break away from Bichet and break away from your identification as his prodigy?
Yeah, it became something. You know, when you're always living in the shadow of a great man, you feel that no matter what you do, you'll always be compared with him, and the comparison will be not favorable to you. So I did want to break away. It got to the point where I was totally identified with him. In fact, the trombonist George Brunis, he used to call us Bash and Shay, and because that was the New Orleans pronunciation of Bechet's name. They used to call him Bashay. So I did want to break away, and one of the ways I did it was to actually give up the soprano saxophone for a number of years and concentrate on the clarinet, and also I played a lot of tenor in those days. I came back to the soprano when I wandered into a music store, I guess it was in the mid-60s, and saw this little curved soprano. I'd never seen one, and it intrigued me. It looked like a little alto saxophone. Of course, the more common soprano is the straight one. So I picked it up and blew a note, and I instantly realized that there was something different about it than the straight soprano. And it gave me the idea that maybe I could do something of my own on the soprano, which would not be totally identified with Bechet.
Well, that curved soprano, it looks like a little baby alto, actually. And yeah, it's become visually your trademark. Not many people play this kind of curved soprano.
Right.
Have you been able to find new ones when you need them?
No, it's very difficult. I had, through the years, I've collected three of them. One of them was stolen from a job once, but I still have the two. But they are very rare. The good ones were made in the 20s.
I want to get back to when you left Bechet. Was it hard for you to find your own identity? Because this was in the 1950s. It was a time when most of the young players who were getting recognized were playing bop of one sort or another.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of music that you never really played or wanted to play.
I appreciated what the bebop players were doing, and I heard them when they were coming up in the 40s on 52nd Street, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk. But I didn't identify with it as far as my feeling about music. It didn't touch me the way Benny and Louis Armstrong and Sidney Bechet did. And you're right, that was a period of searching for me, the 50s and the 60s, when I was trying to find my own identity and trying to find where do I belong in this crazy jazz world. I describe this in my book, and I had some pretty low times before I began to feel that I knew who I was. And the title, I think, refers to the fact that
The title being Music was not enough.
Yeah, I figured when I was young that music was going to be the answer to everything. You know, I could forget about any other problems dealing with human relationships or anything of that sort, because music was going to be the answer. And I found, particularly in this period of searching, that you had to be more than just a musician. You had to be a human being, and you had to relate to people. And this has become increasingly important to me as I grow older. And my friends and my wife, who's such a support to me, Pug Horton, they're more important to me than anything else.
Well, you know, one of the things I really value about the kind of repertory music that you frequently play is that it doesn't come with the costumes and all the little period tacky touches. You know how a lot of those bands have to, like the kind of trad bands, the musicians would have to wear the striped shirts and the visors and act like they were in some kind of play.
That's right, yeah. No, I try to avoid anything which gives the impression that the music is dated or old-fashioned. For instance, bands playing traditional jazz, many of them consider it's absolutely necessary to have a tuba and a banjo. Well, it's not necessary at all. But those instruments can be played very musically, you know. But the thing to do is to capture the essence, the spirit of the music.
Well, I want to play some more of your music, but first I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and I wish you the best in your Carnegie Hall concert coming up this Saturday.
Terry, thanks. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you. Okay. My guest has been musician Bob Wilbur. Many of his recordings on Fantastic and Jazzology are now being reissued on compact disc. He has a new autobiography titled Music Was Not Enough, and that will be published probably next month in the United States by Oxford University Press. This Saturday, he'll perform in New York City in a concert that's a tribute to Benny Goodman on the anniversary of Goodman's historic 1938 Carnegie Hall concert. This concert, too, will be held in Carnegie Hall. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Ron Reagan Jr. The president's son will appear in his own HBO comedy special, which debuts on January 15th, so I hope you can join us. Well, here's Bob Wilbur on soprano saxophone, Dick Wellstead at the piano, performing Louis Armstrong's Cornet Chop Suey, but retitled to Soprano Chop Suey.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with comic Kate Clinton. Her material draws from her own experiences as a feminist and lesbian. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new recording of Akhenaten, an opera by composer Philip Glass. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines language in the postmodern age. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. The Supreme Court today issued a ruling that gives high school students fewer constitutional rights than adults. NPR's Nina Totenberg explains.
This test case involving student rights came from St. Louis, Missouri, where the principal of the Hazelwood East High School censored articles in the school paper. The paper was prepared by students as part of a journalism course and was supervised by the teacher of the course. But the principal had final veto authority. He objected to an article about the impact of divorce on students and an article about teen pregnancy at the school. The articles were deleted from the paper. The students challenged the action in court, claiming it violated their First Amendment right to freedom of expression. Today, the Supreme Court ruled against the students by a 6-3 vote. Writing for the court, Justice Byron White said students do not have the same First Amendment rights as adults. Educators, said White, are free to control the style and content of student speech in school-sponsored activities as long as the controlling actions are reasonably related to educational concerns. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
The National Geographic Society is setting up a foundation to help teach kids about the world. The Society's president, Gilbert Grosvenor, said today that $20 million will be set aside to combat geographic illiteracy. And he promised to add another $20 million if the Society can raise an equal amount in outside contributions. Grosvenor says the foundation will concentrate on training teachers. Today is the 100th anniversary of the National Geographic Society. A new study by the U.S. Health and Human Services Department shows that drug use among high school students is changing. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Researchers said for the first time in 8 years, cocaine use by high school seniors showed a significant drop. The report also said the use of crack, an extremely dangerous form of cocaine, leveled out in 1987. The data used in the study does not include drug use by the 20% of students who drop out of high school. But despite the decline, one in every six high school seniors has tried cocaine, and one in 18 has tried crack. The study also noted a gradual decline in the use of other illicit drugs, including marijuana. HHS Secretary Otis Bowen attributed the decline to a number of factors: the drug death of basketball star Lynn Bias, a public service campaign in the media, and a concerted effort by parents, schools, and other organizations. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
Japan's Prime Minister Takeshita and President Reagan met for 2 hours at the White House today. Takeshita assured the president that Japan would try to stimulate its economy and open its markets to reduce the huge trade gap between the two countries. The president said he and Takeshita also talked about mutual security concerns.
I was satisfied to note that U.S.-Japan cooperation in the national security area is strong and growing, and that Japan's recently announced budget provides for continued significant increases in the area of national defense. Japan's growing contribution to the maintenance of U.S. forces in Japan is of immense value to the United States.
The president met with Takeshita today despite a bout of nausea and vomiting overnight. Mr. Reagan says he feels fine now. His doctors say his stomach problems were probably caused by a mild virus. The president is scheduled for a routine physical exam at Bethesda Naval Medical Center on Friday. The White House says the checkup was not prompted by Mr. Reagan's illness. Stock prices fell slightly in mixed trading on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was off more than 3 points, closing at 1924.73. Advances led declines by about 100 issues on volume of 154 million shares. I'm Mara Liasson. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Philip Glass has composed a trilogy of portrait operas about great men: Einstein on the Beach, Satyagraha about Mahatma Gandhi, and Akhenaten. Akhenaten was commissioned by the Stuttgart State Opera in 1982 and was given its world premiere there in 1984. CBS has just released a recording of the opera. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Philip Glass's Akhenaten has a great story behind it, the story of the Egyptian pharaoh who invented monotheism and brought it to his kingdom for one brief shining moment. 17 years, actually, before the overwhelming forces of tradition, conformity, and conservatism destroyed him. Organized in conventional operatic scenes, Akhenaten could have turned into a hyper-romanticized Hollywood epic like The Egyptian, which told the same story.
Thank you.
So Glass and his literary and scenic collaborators, Shalom Goldman, Robert Israel, and Richard Rydell, give us the story in a printed plot summary and present instead a spectacle of symbolic images, sung, recited, mimed, and danced. The libretto consists of disconnected passages drawn mainly from ancient writing. They're sung or spoken in English, wordless vowels, and a modern rendering of ancient Egyptian, Akkadian, and Biblical Hebrew. On records, Akhenaten seems a kind of symphonic cantata or oratorio, with solo and choral passages surrounded by extended minimalist tone poems. The funeral of Akhenaten's father, Akhenaten's coronation, Akhenaten pulling down the roof of the old temple. Vocal highlights include Akhenaten's love duet with his wife Nefertiti, a trio announcing the dawn of the new age, and Akhenaten's hymn to Aten, the new god. Glass calls this ecstatic, almost pop music pretty aria the central moment of the opera and wants it to be sung in whatever language the audience speaks. At the end, a present-day guide leads tourists through the ruins, and the ancient ghosts finally join the funeral procession the opera began with. Glass clearly realizes that the minimalist style doesn't work with conventional operatic recitative or dialogue. Its repeated modules seem more appropriate for ritual than drama. Ironically, it also reminds me of movie music. The main recurrent motif is like Bernard Herrmann's haunting theme churning and churning ominously under the main titles of Vertigo. Could he, or Alfred Hitchcock, have been the real father of minimalism? I don't think Glass's orchestration has ever been more dazzlingly colorful. Sometimes it's almost schlocky in its easy excess. The fall of Akhenaten sounds like a cross between Borodin's Polovtsian dances and the triumphal scene from Aida. Dennis Russell Davies conducts the orchestra and chorus of the Stuttgart State Opera with amazing precision and passion. The soloists, especially early music countertenor Paul Eswood, negotiate the intricate, insinuating harmonies brilliantly. Actor David Warlow as the scribe, the Egyptian also begins with a scribe, gets a bit portentous on the orotundity, though.
Nay. But I will make the city of the horizon for the Aten, my father, upon the east side, the place for which he did enclose for his own self with cliffs, and made a plain in the midst of it, that I might sacrifice to him thereon. This is it.
This is one of the main problems with Akhenaten. For all its variety of texture and pace, the overall tone is oppressively solemn, very different from the wit of Einstein on the beach. And because the music sometimes doesn't seem very deep or genuine, the solemnity often seems pretentious or melodramatic. So for all its exciting and even moving passages, the whole thing feels a little like being in church for 2 hours, or like a Hollywood version of church.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the CBS recording of the Philip Glass opera, Akhenaten. This is Fresh Air. My guest is stand-up comic Kate Clinton. Her humor is about being a lesbian and a feminist in a heterosexual world. Kate's talent was nurtured coming up through the ranks of the women's movement, playing at women's festivals and conferences. Now she's one of the few openly gay comics who's broken into the comedy circuit. Kate's first audiences were her students during the 8 years she taught high school English. Now in her routines, Kate Clinton talks about issues that no one else does.
Now, when I was in second grade, it seemed like a lot of my friends were terribly worried, very, very worried about the fifth commandment. I was not worried about the fifth commandment. The most terrifying commandment I ever heard was good old number 9. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. That commandment, and I thought it had my name on it.
A lot of times what is the mainstream of comedy is essentially the men's experience. I think a lot of times women are just surprised to hear somebody talking about things that we go through. I just turned 40, and I've started to talk about it, and there's a laugh of recognition, almost a relief that women are going to hear somebody talking about getting older without talking about body parts falling off or sagging down or any of that. I think it's a great resource. I think that, you know, Bill Cosby, every time he gets a wrinkle, he writes a book about it. And I think that women don't hear enough about women getting older in a positive way.
Another subject that you cover that really nobody else does. You talk about how absurd you find the emphasis on phallus size in gay male classified ads.
Yes, and I think it's hysterical because women in women's papers, we don't we're not size queens anyway. And I was in Provincetown this summer, and it was really quite an education for me in terms of gay culture. I've known about feminist culture and lesbian culture for a long time, but it was really my first experience in gay culture. So, I mean, Terry, the concept of I don't understand female impersonation. And so being there was just, it was very, very interesting to me. To me, it's like the thrill of, I guess, dressing up like Perry Como and wearing a big pair of boxer shorts and doing some of his old tunes. And I didn't understand it. And I was asked to judge a drag show. Now, the point of a drag show is you go in and the guys are, they dress up in, you know, to do the woman perfectly that they're impersonating, and they wear the exact same clothes, they make the same movements, they do the same songs. But then they would come out and they said, we want you to judge this drag show, but we want you to judge it on originality. And I could not figure out what was original here.
You've said that as a feminist comic that you promised yourself that you wouldn't make fun of other women, but on the other hand, some women are just too tempting.
Too tempting.
Did you really, though, make that kind of pact with yourself that as a feminist comic you shouldn't mock other women?
I think that women are warned about humor. I think certainly when I was growing up, you weren't allowed to make fun of boys. And so you learned a kind of horizontal kind of humor where you'd make fun of other women or of yourself. I think that's what is rewarded still very much in the mainstream culture, is that women make fun of other women. And so I really try not to, although it is very tempting. some women are just kind of, yeah, you do have to talk about them. But I did make that pact with myself, certainly that I wouldn't make fun of myself, and certainly that I wouldn't really, you know, as a career move, make fun of other women.
I bet there's a lot of women comics who are lesbians but who aren't out publicly. They're not out in the entertainment world. And mm-hmm. they probably really wish that they could do the kind of material that you could do.
Mm-hmm. And I think that I have come up in it through a different system. I came up really through the women's music system. And there's a really well-developed network of what we call women's music. So I was able to perform at colleges and to perform at conferences, and a different kind of thing than a comedy club. I think comedy clubs now are very, very difficult and quite misogynist places for women to do their work. And I think that women who even talk about sexuality in comedy clubs have a difficult time, if it's not about dating.
You got started playing to women audiences on the women's music circuit mm-hmm. and at women's festivals, at women's studies conferences. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those audiences, first of all, there's no men who are there for the conference. Second of all, there's been a lot of exclusive concerts where men really are not invited.
Right.
But what was it like for you when you started to play to audiences in which there were men present? Were you prepared for that?
I think when I first thought about performing to a more mixed audience, I was kind of concerned. And then, you know, then I thought, God, I taught high school English for 8 years, and that certainly was a mixed audience. And they, you know, they listened. And I really felt that, you know, it was certainly a political decision. And I really felt that it was important to say that I was a feminist comedian, mostly. And you wouldn't believe that people really like to talk to me because they can't believe that those two things go together. You know, feminist and humorist. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a political decision. I made it. And in fact, what's happened is that the audiences are widening. And I think it's what I believe about feminism, and is that it's a very inclusive concept.
You're breaking into, quote, mainstream comedy clubs now.
Mm-hmm.
And you're breaking into the comedy circuit.
Mm-hmm.
Comedy is in some ways almost like a men's fraternity. There aren't that many women who've really made it to the top. And I can't think of a whole lot of lesbian feminist comics who have made it to the top.
Right, right.
Now, you probably hear a lot of really offensive routines mm-hmm. in the comedy clubs. If you hear someone, if you hear a man who's doing something you find really offensive, do you say something or do you just let it go? What do you do?
Well, I have found that hissing is very good. And because what you do is you destroy a kind of a rhythm that the person has with that particular line, and that person never does that line again with any kind of confidence. I have encouraged people to do that. It's very interesting when it comes back on you, but I generally try to talk to people, you know, if there's any hope at all, or if I you know, I feel that the energy isn't completely wasted talking to them about what I find, that it's really difficult for me to hear that part.
Can your family deal with you being a public lesbian? Since you're a lesbian in your professional work, you know, mm-hmm. it's everyone who sees your act or hears your records mm-hmm. knows that you are. Can your family cope with that? Do they ever have problems with it?
I think they had problems in the beginning. We're kind of a quiet family. Kind of a raised eyebrow.
They are,
an
you're
overstatement.
Not.
In my family, I think my dad would prefer if I, you know, I said, Dad, wouldn't you like to come to a show? And he's just not ready yet. He thinks maybe he'd go in Portland, Oregon. You know, he lives in Syracuse, New York, but they're doing well. They're proud of me.
In your routines, you describe yourself as a recovering Catholic. Mm-hmm. Did you go through a long period of guilt for being a lesbian?
You know, I actually went through a longer period of guilt for not being a Catholic, even when I was trying to be one. And because I wasn't real strong in those beliefs, I think it was easier for me to come to terms with being a lesbian than other Catholic women.
Have you done any television yet?
I've done a couple of things. I did a show called Comedy Tonight for KQED, and I did a show in Canada out of Toronto.
What do you think the chances are that you would be allowed to break into the TV comedy circuit?
I don't know. You know, I think that there's a kind of homogeneity about comedy right now because everyone is trying to make their routines go into 6 perfect minutes for David Letterman or for Johnny Carson, and they're not so topical because they need to be able to be played in reruns. I don't know, but I think that what I'm thinking is that it's a kind of a gimmick that certainly no one else is talking about, and if someone courageous or you know, interested in putting their career on the line, heard me, I think that that is a possibility of breaking into TV comedy.
You're performing to different kinds of audiences now. You mm-hmm. perform to lesbian audiences, to feminist audiences, and also to mixed audiences and straight audiences.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find yourself doing different material depending on who the audience is? And do you think that any of the women, any of the lesbians who are your followers really want you to keep certain material just for them and to not kind of share that with the straight world?
I think so. I think that I call them trade secrets. I think that, yes, women sometimes get nervous, and I'm very cautious about what I say to a very mixed audience. You kind of build up a trust level to, and you find out how much they can hear, and you go from there.
Kate, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, dear.
Comedian Kate Clinton spoke with us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. Her latest recording is Kate Clinton, live at the Great American Music Hall on Wisecrack Records. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, in a case involving a high school in St. Louis, the Supreme Court ruled today that school officials have broad power to censor student journalists, and we'll have a report on that. Also, transition of power in Taiwan following the death of President Jiang Jingguo. One expert says great changes have taken place in Taiwan, economically especially, but also recently politically, but that the new Taiwanese-born president is not expected to institute major political reforms. And news tonight on the most distant of our solar system's planets, Pluto. It may turn out that its moon is just another planet.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on the language of postmodernism, a movement that is a reaction to and a comment on all that's come before.
This is, they say, the postmodern age. Postmodernism is about self-reference, about distance and irony. It is about the architecture of Michael Graves and Philip Johnson, which wears its mock Egyptian columns and Chippendale rooflines the way Steve Martin wears an arrow through his head. It is about TV shows like Moonlighting, with its studied homages to the styles of 40s movies, and its self-conscious references to its own writers and directors. It is about retro design as trendy homeowners gut the interiors of the Victorians to resemble the bar of a 50s bowling alley. And as much as anything else, postmodernism is about all those rampant new uses of the preposition about itself. About is a very important preposition for those of us who spend our time reflecting on language and meaning. It's the word you use to describe the relation between things that tell stories and the things in the world they describe. You can have a sentence about trout fishing, a book about nuclear disarmament, or a film about Vietnam. But what does it mean when somebody writes in the San Francisco Chronicle, a $150 designer teapot isn't about making tea, it's about letting people know that you have $150 to spend on a teapot? In the old days of pre-postmodernism, we thought of a teapot as being for, not about. But in the postmodern age, everything is interpreted as a text about something else. We live, as Roland Barthes would have said, in an empire of signs. About is not the only language word that's been co-opted by the postmodern sensibility. A house that once would have been called old-fashioned is now vernacular or idiomatic. A store in Washington, D.C. advertises bathroom products that make a statement. And then there's metaphor. In the past few weeks, I have read that football is a metaphor for war, that looking is a metaphor for shopping, and that baking, tail fins, and rock music are all metaphors for sex. If you want a sustained example of the effects of postmodernism on the language, take these lines from a recent review by Kay Larson in New York Magazine. Nancy Graves' new work is a bold statement about the new relationship between sculpture, science, and nature. The twists and turns of her career have not changed her argument, which is now even more expressive. There would be nothing wrong with this if Nancy Graves were a critic or historian, but in point of fact, she's a sculptor, and what Larson calls her argument is constructed out of painted bronze. Now, I don't think you can dismiss this kind of talk out of hand. It's undeniable that a lot of modern culture is indeed highly linguistic, in the sense that it acquires its meaning by self-conscious reference to other works and other styles. It's fair enough to say that Andy Warhol's work was primarily about. Certainly it wouldn't mean a whole lot to somebody who had never seen Marilyn Monroe or a can of Campbell's soup. And as the French Marxist writer Jean Baudrillard has observed, the postmodernist sensibility is a natural outgrowth of a modern consumerist culture. If you want to understand why people will pay a $20 premium for the right to wear a little polo pony on the breast of their T-shirts, you have to acknowledge that the pony is a kind of linguistic abbreviation for all of those luxurious interiors in the Ralph Lauren ads. But if you take the sensibility too far, it becomes both brittle and a little sad. If everything in the world has to be read as a reference to something else, then nothing has any authentic value of its own. The semiotician and novelist Umberto Eco once described the problem aptly as follows. In the postmodern age, you cannot say simply, I love you. You must say, I love you, as Barbara Cartland would say. It would be well to realize that some things are not about, they just are. Not every teapot contains a narrative, and not every picture tells a story.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with the Chicago-based composer, arranger, and saxophonist Edward Wilkerson. He's one of the few contemporary composers who leads a big band. He also leads an octet, and they have a new record. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Letters from Mississippi, the new album from Eddie Hinton that mixes rock, soul, and R&B. And film critic Stephen Schiff looks at the box office smash Three Men and a Baby. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station that's recently joined Fresh Air, WUWM, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance today from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.